Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode number 110, recorded Thursday, August 25th, 2011. Invasion of the Marmocrabs. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Once again, it is the hour of science that we spend talking to one expert about one topic. So I hope you're ready to get dirty because we're ready to dig in to an invasion of sorts. The Marmocrabs are coming. Well, maybe not here, but definitely to Madagascar and Japan, where they're certainly a source of consternation to the country's rice farmers and ecologists. And to do that, I'm joined by neuroethologist Dr. Zen Falks from the University of Texas Pan American, where he runs the country's foremost Marmocrabs research and breeding lab. What is the dreaded Marmocrabs? Well, you're going to have to wait and see, because first, we have our science news headlines. What's up first? Well, the journal Science reports that a planet made of diamonds has been found orbiting a pulsar 4,000 light years away in the constellation Serpens. Scientists think it is actually the remains of a white dwarf star. And seriously, where is Doctor Who when I need him? Anyone up for a visit to the diamond planet? Scientists are starting to look at the question of cosmic ray involvement in cloud formation. Do they or don't they increase cloud cover? The Cosmics Leaving Outdoor Droplets, or CLOUD project at CERN, reported its first results in Nature this week, supporting the role of sulfuric acid nucleation and ammonia in forming water droplets. While not confirming or negating the involvement of cosmic rays, the project has confirmed that subatomic particles are also involved in increasing nucleation rate and water droplet formation, and that the ionization-based nucleation process is dependent on temperature. Nothing yet can be linked directly to cloud formation, so wait for more science to come on this project. Scientists have confirmed the existence of a cold, deep water current called the North Icelandic Jet off of Iceland. It is said to have a major influence on the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, suggesting that water melt in the North Atlantic might be less important than thought in weakening that conveyor belt system. Los Alamos scientists have broken a world record. Last week, they achieved a pulsed magnetic field of 92.5 Tesla. And then they surpassed their record with a 95 Tesla pulse, bringing science that much closer to creating a magnetic field pulse of 100 Tesla. Only five more to go. Woot! We're going to get there. A report just published today by the Institute of Medicine says that vaccines are largely safe. The eight vaccines reviewed were for chickenpox, influenza, hep B, HPV, diphtheria, DTaP, which is tetanus and pertussis, MMR, hep A, and meningococcal disease. The more serious reactions noted in the report only occurred in children with weakened immune systems. And the report rejects links between MMR and autism and the DTaP vaccine and type 1 diabetes. More information, be sure to check out that report for yourself. Scientists looking at genes involved in the immune response suggested that interbreeding with Neanderthals was good for our health. As Homo sapiens spread out of Africa, the HLA genes acquired from Neanderthals and Denisovians gave modern humans an immune advantage while spreading into their new environments. Researchers did a better job this time around of accessing the correct population and found that real bisexual men do exist. A small 160 million-year-old rat-like fossil found in China has pushed back the emergence of placental mammals by a good 35 million years. The find confirms estimates of placental emergence based on the DNA-based molecular clock. According to a recent analysis published in the Public Library of Science Biology, there are about 8.7 million species on the planet, give or take 1.3 million. 2.2 million of those species are in the oceans, give or take about 180,000, and at least 86% of them have yet to be described. Get to work, biologists! There's a lot more species to cover. And finally, publishing in the journal Science and looking at over 2,000 species, scientists report that animals and plants are shifting to the cooler north at 17 kilometers per year. This is three times the speed that was previously thought. Those organisms that experience the greatest change in temperature move the fastest. And so let's move quickly into our first sponsor message. This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and shows on your Mac, PC, iPad, iPhone, Android phone. If you have a gaming console, you can watch it on that, like an Xbox 360, PS3, Nintendo Wii, those kinds of things, right on your TV. If you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV using a box set-top device, like an Apple TV or a Roku box. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices. And you can begin watching a movie or a show on one device, stop watching it, and then finish it on another one. Whatever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time. So try Netflix today for free for 30 days. Go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free 30-day trial. It's Netflix, netflix.com/twit, T-W-I-T. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and we hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. Now, back to the show. It is time to bring in our guest expert. According to his Twitter profile, Dr. Zen Fox is a Canadian in Texas. Oh, heavens. Associate professor at the University of Texas Pan American, studying brains, behavior, and evolution, mostly using crustaceans, although he has a history with the octopuses of the world. He has a specific interest in the marbled crayfish, otherwise known as marmocrebs. Dr. Fulks, thank you for joining me and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great fun to be here.
You're welcome. So tell me a little bit how you got into this study of marmocrebs. Why a crayfish?
Well, I've been working with crustaceans for a while. I've worked with all kinds of different species, and this is one of those cases where it's a great example of why you can never tell where research is going to take you. And I was working on a project looking at neurons in other crustaceans, and I figured out at some point that really one of the things I needed to do to figure out what was going on with some of these neurons was I wanted to see how they developed in the animal. You know, so as you get from a little itty-bitty animal to a bigger animal, right, the neurons change and you've got to see what's going on there. And it's actually kind of a pain to rear a lot of crustaceans. And I learned about these crayfish, which are incredibly cool because they are the only known crustacean, decapod crustacean, that are all female, and they reproduce themselves by cloning. And so I looked at that and went, wow, is going to make things a lot easier to study development, because these crayfish will just every few months kick out a new batch of eggs, And so I can study the development of the nervous system. That way I can leave them on their own. I don't have to worry about all that complicated stuff in terms of sex, you know, when you have to, because everybody knows that sex is complicated, right? You have to get two animals at the same place at the same time, and crayfish are aggressive and they tend to fight. And so I just thought, this is going to make my life so much easier to work with these animals versus the other crayfish that I've been working with before. And that
was, is it easier than you?
It isn't one
of those situations where you said this is going to be easier, and then it turned out to be much harder.
It did turn out to be harder, but it's still easier than what I did have planned, without question.
So the crayfish, this marbled crayfish, it has the nickname Marmokrebs. That's kind of a cute nickname. It does sound like something that you would possibly find in a Japanese thriller movie.
Exactly.
You know, Mothra, Marmokrebs.
Well, yes. I mean, that's one of the fun things about this is that I work with an animal that sounds, for all the world, like something out of science fiction. I mean, it's great fun to say, I'm Dr. Zen and I have an army of female clones. What's that like about?
I know, and it's true.
And it is true, I know. But yeah, the Marmokrebs is German, okay? So the story behind these guys, or gals, as the case may be, I tend to use guys for both men and women. The story behind these gals is that they actually showed up in the pet trade in Europe back in about the 1990s or so. And it's not clear where they came from. At the time, the people who were pet owners were looking at these and going, there's something strange going on here. We have one. I put it in the tank when it was really, really little. It's never seen another one, and it's got eggs, and the eggs are giving babies. And I thought crayfish were supposed to be like, you know, two to tango and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
So they had no species name. And so they called them marbled crayfish in German, of course, because it was in Germany. And the German translation for that is Marmokrebs. So that's the origin of the name.
Okay.
And actually, I can show. Come here, little girl. Ah!
Oh, we get to see one. This is great. I love show and tell. So, while he struggles with the marbled crayfish, Marmokrebs, there we go.
So you can see, or maybe you can't. Let me bring it back here a little bit. Try and keep it in frame. But this is these little crayfish here. So this is one of my Marmokrebs, and they do get bigger, but they're a small species of crayfish. They're not like some of these. I've seen some crayfish that are lobster sized, particularly the Australian crayfish. A lot of those can get very, very large. But this one is, as you can see, fits nicely in my hand. And it's probably hard, unless somebody is looking at a very high resolution connection, to really see the marbling on this animal.
Mm-hmm.
But this animal of this size would be reproductive. So and they get reproductive after about 7-9 months of age, and they can live for 2 or 3 years and have multiple batches of eggs.
So that's a big question, is how much can they reproduce? So they don't have to rely on the opposite sex to reproduce.
Right.
So they can pretty much reproduce as much as they want until they get too old, or they're eaten, or they die from other causes.
And I can't remember what the record is, but one that comes to mind is a paper where one of these animals was found in a lake in Germany, and it had, in one clutch of eggs, 740 or 750, somewhere along those lines, but it was between 700 and 800.
And what kind of a mortality rate do they normally have? I mean, is that kind of, when you think about the ecological impact that these crayfish have, you know, how fast and easily can they just take over?
Well, in terms of the mortality, actually for crayfish, the mortality does tend to be fairly high because you have to remember that these are animals that have their skeletons on the outside. And you can imagine what it would be like if every time you wanted to grow, you had to get rid of your entire skeleton. It makes me so glad that my skeleton is internal.
Right.
With these guys, when they're really, really little and they're growing, and they're growing at quite, you know, so if you grow just a little tiny bit, it's like, oh, I'm out of skeleton. I have to make a new skeleton. So they're at that point, when they're really young and they're growing quite fast, they're going through a lot of skeletons, basically.
So they molt a lot.
It's fairly tricky, and so the mortality, that doesn't always go well for them. So a lot of times when I have an animal die, it's because a molt has gone bad.
Huh.
And it's not been able to pull itself out of its old skeleton properly, and it gets all gimped up and not good.
That's interesting, and I'd never actually thought of that being a factor for mortality in organisms with exoskeletons, that they might actually get trapped in their exoskeleton. But that's a good thing that they don't survive, because you don't want, you know, an exoskeleton that doesn't fit. You're not going to survive very well anyway. So, you know, survivability-wise, that's probably better.
But of course, the problem is not so much how many offspring they have, but that it only takes one. Because, you know, for any other animal, or almost any other animal, if one gets loose, big deal, right? It's like, it can't reproduce, it's, you know, it can just go out and live its life and it'll die off. And here, if one gets loose, every single one is reproductive. So the threshold for problems is low.
Yeah, very low. Because it doesn't take two to tango. So do they have different environmental situations in which they would reproduce through parthenogenesis, or this the cloning of the females versus a sexual reproduction? Do they have two different reproductive states, or are they fully parthenogenic? Well,
this gets back to how little we know about this. So when they showed up in the pet trade, the scientists who finally sort of clued into the fact the pet owners were actually onto something, they went to some of the people who were selling these things as pets, and they tried to track back what the source of these things were, and the story that they got was completely confused, just not reliable at all. So we had this complete mystery. They looked like they were North American species, and it turns out that their closest relative is a North American species. And so it's probably the case that these were brought from North America. But between that and their discovery, it's not at all clear what's going on. So the closest relative to these guys is a Florida crayfish. And it's not at all clear if the Florida species, if there's like any of these marmocrebs, these asexual ones, that you just will occasionally find in the native population, which is normally sexual. Because that happens in some species. You will find that they will be able to do either, or you'll find in some conditions they reproduce sexually, in some conditions they reproduce asexually, we just don't know at this point.
Huh, that's really interesting. So are there individuals looking at how they cope with environmental stresses? So since they've really only been seen in crayfish tanks and fish tanks, and now out in the wild, do we know how the parthenogenesis leads to their changes in their diversity, how their genes can actually handle environmental stress and affect survival? Are they really great generalists, and so they have a good, you know, just a good survival base to begin with, or do they have, what's their kryptonite?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that pretty much anybody that I know who's worked with crayfish admires about them, and this includes me, is that crayfish are tough little survivors. They are tough as nails, most of them, right? And these animals are sort of no exception. Crayfish, just in general, tend to be really, really hardy. And in terms of what their kryptonite is, I suppose that the one thing is that they are actually a fairly small species. And so compared to, if they get into a situation where they're competing against some other species, they may not completely predominate the lake or the pond or whatever they get into.
Right.
Unless they do it just through sheer dint of numbers. But I mean, that's not at all clear how that's going to shake out right now. And certainly in terms of the fact that they're clones, a lot of people say, well, they're all genetically identical, right? So they're all going to be the same. Turns out that there actually is a lot of variation, just the same way that two people who are identical twins can actually be fairly different.
Yeah.
Not as different as like two fraternal twins or two different, you know, brothers or sisters, but they are not truly identical. And
right.
It's the same thing with these crayfish. There's a lot of variation in them. And that's something that I have a student working with me right now. We're trying to figure out if there are certain conditions that will make them where they can get, say, spinier or bigger or smaller, or how they can change in response to their environment.
Right, right. If they do have built-in, like I said earlier, built-in diversity, genetic adaptability.
Well, they don't have genetic adaptability, but they have adaptability just in terms of the same adaptability that you see anytime an organism grows.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact of the things that happen around you when you are growing up, there's that developmental variation, that variation mm-hmm. in growth that everything has.
Right. Is there anything really interesting about their behavior? And do they have you seen novel behaviors or I guess a variety of behaviors that can be elicited in different situations? So not just what they look like, so their form, right. but also how they function in their environment.
You know, I think not yet. I've had some students who've been working with me on doing behavioral kinds of projects, but in terms of how much variation they have in their behavior, don't know yet. I mean, crayfish are pretty adaptable, but I mean, they're not the sharpest tools in the shed in terms of behavior.
Yeah.
You know, they're not like octopus, right? They're not great problem solvers or I mean, certainly they've turned out to be more sophisticated than people first thought. So some colleagues of mine did this paper that they published a couple of years ago showing that crayfish could recognize patterns on their faces, and they could basically recognize faces of other crayfish. You know, so they're a little bit smarter than you might give them credit for. But, I mean, I have to say that they're still not the brightest creatures on the planet. So far, I haven't found a lot of different things to test in terms of what different kinds of behaviors they might show.
Right. So in terms of predator avoidance or food acquisition, some of the basic survival stuff.
As I said, that's one of the things I'm working on.
Yeah. It just seems normal. They are the very average scourge of the rivers. If you don't want to be average, maybe you should check out Squarespace. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com has an easy-to-use UI for creating and managing a website or a blog. It's optimized for both beginners and CSS experts, so no matter your level of ability, you can use Squarespace. There are hundreds of design templates to choose from, and you can customize any of them to fit your needs. iPhone and iPad apps are available for updating your blog on the go. Online resources and a special support team are there to give you personal help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the service includes all sorts of modules to help you build your website so your website can do what you want it to do. There's also website tracking, so you know how your site's being viewed, a search engine optimizer, permission access handling, cloud architecture for speed and site stability. Use Squarespace for all of your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it anytime. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com, sign up for a free account, no credit card needed. Just try it out. Start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase it, use the offer code KIKI8 and get 10% off of your account for 6 months. That's right. That's squarespace.com. And use the offer code KIKI8. KIKI8. Maybe Kiki ate a Marmor Krebs. Not quite. Back to the show. Are they tasty? I mean, crayfish are a tasty food some people enjoy quite a lot. Are these a species that might be good for, you know, maybe saving some of the endemic crayfish populations and being good for eating?
Well, as I showed you before, they're not a very big crayfish.
Yeah, they're not too, they're not too big. Yeah.
But as I said, they do get bigger than the one I showed a little earlier. But I mean, even so, as I said, there's bigger crayfish out there if you're just looking for food. And in terms of whether they're good to eat, I mean, I've actually heard, I don't eat my subjects, okay? I just want to make that clear.
Okay, and, good to know.
It's a no-no. And
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, crayfish, lots of people eat crayfish. And I mean, there was a New York restaurant that got in trouble a little while ago for advertising a lobster salad, and it turned out there were crayfish, and some people were arguing about whether that was a legitimate thing to advertise it as a lobster salad when it didn't have actual lobster in it.
Are they both decapod crustaceans?
Yeah.
So they're similar.
The problem is that lobster, there's at least three different kinds of critters that are commonly called lobster.
Oh, okay? Wow.
So you've got clawed lobster, which are the big American ones that they sell in Maine and Boston and places like that. You've got the spiny lobster, which is the one they pick up from the Caribbean and Florida and California. And then you've got spot lobster, which are also called langostino lobster, which are much smaller, and they're found in all different kinds of places. So what you call a lobster, in terms of what that means biologically, is kind of anything goes. Not anything goes, but the English language and the scientific language don't always line up.
Right. Yeah, I find that really interesting. I mean, there are lots of cases in which you say that it's a particular kind of fish, turns out to not be that specific fish, but it's a similar white fish, as you say, in lobster. For the Marmor Krebs, I mean, what we're interested in, I think, is the danger of a species like Marmor Krebs becoming, I mean, it is invasive. Yeah. Is it the worry that we don't understand enough about it to stop its invasiveness, or to understand exactly the impact it's going to have on the ecosystems that it invades?
Well, there's been plenty of cases of crayfish that have gotten loose. So the crayfish in North America that a lot of people are maybe familiar with is the Louisiana red swamp crayfish. So lots of places have crayfish boils, and they have Louisiana red swamp crayfish. If you go down to New Orleans, you get Louisiana red swamp crayfish. That crayfish is in every continent of the world except Antarctica and I think Australia. And so
wow.
It's in Asia all over the place. It's in Japan. It's in China. It's been introduced into Africa. It's been introduced into Europe. And it's doing fine. And it's been spread all over North America. Actually, I shouldn't say, it might not be in South America, but I'm almost certain that it is because it's been so widely spread. And particularly in Europe, where they've had several North American species that have been brought in. I went to a crayfish meeting last year, and the situation in Europe was just a horror show with the invasive crayfish because they cause huge, huge problems, and particularly in the UK, right? So England, Scotland, Ireland is really worried because they're not there yet, but in England and Scotland and Great Britain, they have gotten them. And there's some of these Scottish lochs where they do culls and they'll pull out millions, literally millions of these North American crayfish. And a lake with crayfish is really different than a lake without crayfish. And what's happened is that once the crayfish get in, the whole food system changes and suddenly there's no more fish. And suddenly the fishermen don't go there anymore. And so the hotels are losing, you know, thousands of pounds over a few months because the fishermen aren't coming. And it's then they're causing problems on for the native crayfish there, which are now highly threatened. So we know that crayfish getting loose causes problems. We've seen it repeatedly. And you mentioned earlier that they've been found in Madagascar. And this also ties back into your earlier question of whether they're good to eat. Because in Madagascar, that's the only place in Africa that has native crayfish. In the rest of Africa, you only get freshwater crabs, normally. And in Madagascar, they actually have native crayfish. And a lot of villages, that's the base of their economy. That's how they make a living, is crayfishing. And it's thought that the reason somebody brought marmor crabs down there was, hey, these reproduce fast, let's toss a few of them into the pond.
Right.
And since then, of course, they've been spreading all over Madagascar, and that's only been for a few years now. But it was probably the case that somebody brought them there for food. And apparently, in Madagascar, some people don't like them as food. And so you sort of wonder, somebody went, didn't think this through.
So the situation now is developing in terms of the marmot crabs' impact, and you don't really know exactly what's going to happen. But you can, if it's based on the knowledge of their ability to reproduce easily and understanding what other crayfish species have done in other ecosystems, the assumption is that it's not going to be good for the local crayfish.
Within Madagascar, they're definitely spreading fast. There's no question about that. So it's not just that they're in one little lake and they're doing fine. No, they're spreading through the lakes and rivers. And in the rice farmers don't like them because the way one crayfish biologist put it is crayfish eat everything and everything eats crayfish. And so because crayfish eat everything, they eat rice plants and they eat rice.
Yeah.
So they really seem to like rice paddies, and that kind of environment seems to suit them very, very well. And so the rice farmers are not very happy because the crayfish are starting to chow down on their rice. And so far, we're not sure how the native crayfish species are reacting. We're not sure how much overlap there's been. And the native crayfish in Madagascar are kind of like the opposite end of the spectrum than the marbled crayfish. The marbled crayfish are small, reproduce fast. The native crayfish are big, they grow slow.
So are they longer lived? Are they a longer lived species also?
Probably. I don't know that for 100% certain, but they probably are because they're bigger.
And yeah.
Crayfish grow kind of at the slow, steady rate. So just like, the great big lobsters that you see that are like, 10, 20 pounds, it takes them a long time to get that big. And they can kind of keep growing indefinitely. Or almost indefinitely. But yeah.
Yeah. Do you know how the native crayfish, how what their reproduction is like? So do they don't reproduce as often? Do they have like one clutch a year, or is it similar to the marmot crabs at all?
Honestly, I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what their rate of reproduction is. It's lower, but I can't tell you sort of how much lower off the top of my head.
Right. For the study of the marmot crabs and where you are going with it, I mean, the behavior and how they interact as an invasive species is obviously interesting, but your background is as a neuroethologist and studying brain and behavior. Is there anything about their crayfish crustacean brain that stands out? Do they have are they typical in terms of how it's set up, or do they have differences neurologically?
I'm working on that.
You're working on it. All right.
I'm a busy guy. I'm not slacking. I'm doing science here. And I have some hints that there might be some interesting differences. But I can't really say more about it yet because I'm not 100% convinced myself yet.
Right.
That there are real differences. And it might just be me fooling myself, which has been known to happen. We're good at that, right? It's like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if it was this way? And so we try and find out if it's that way. And it's like, we still have this idea of, wow, this would be really cool. And so we put a lot of time and effort, and it doesn't always turn out that way. But I have some hints that they might be different. But the problem is that right now, one of the things that I want to do is I don't have their closest relative. This other Florida species that I mentioned, which are called the slough crayfish, and which are the sexual form of the marbled crayfish. And so the species I'm comparing them to are a little more distantly related. So anything I find, I sort of don't know if it's related to the fact that the marbled crayfish are asexual and they have this weird reproductive system, which might mean that their genetics are kind of messed up.
Right.
Or if it's just that's kind of the way their closest relative is. So it's always tricky when you're doing evolutionary studies to find the right comparisons.
Yeah, being able to actually figure that out. So this Florida species, I'm fascinated by the fact that you have a species in Florida and then you have a species that showed up in Germany.
Yep.
How evolutionarily, how are they so closely related? Do you have any idea about the family tree?
It's they showed up there because they were there as pets.
Just
and
pets.
And one of the things that I've looked at is, I've talked a little bit about they've been found, the marble crayfish have been found, they're introduced in Madagascar where they're spreading. In Germany, there's a couple of places where there's established populations. One's been found just alone in Japan. In North America, there haven't been any marbled crayfish found in the wild. I'm hoping it's going to stay that way. I'm really, really hoping it's going to stay that way. But they're really easy to find in the pet trade. And on one of my websites, I actually did a survey of pet owners. And I said, things like, well, when did you get your first marbled crayfish? What do you feed them? And asking those kinds of questions. And the earliest one was actually like only 1 year after the sort of the first scientific paper about these guys. So they'd already been to Germany and they'd come back through the pet trade. And I'm sort of trying to keep tabs of where they are in North America. And they're all over the place in North America. And they're sold, again, the marble crayfish, they're clearly sold as pets in Asia as well. They're in Canada, U.S., all over Europe. And there's definitely some cases where introductions and where single individuals have been found in Europe have been traced back to somebody, a pet owner, just sort of dumping the tank or releasing them into the wild. And pet owners have not a great track record as a whole in keeping things in their tanks. You know, there's been plenty of things that have gotten loose in one place or another. And in Florida, you know, it's kind of a mess right now because they've got pythons and they've had the
wild
fish and
lots of people
be responsible.
Please don't just release your animals into the wild. So is there a possibility that this species, that it split off in captivity? Or is this a species that, you know, we know where it came from in the wild?
It's a lot of people have talked about that as a possibility, that it's a captivity issue. That it was something that happened. Because when you look at a lot of asexual animals, a lot of those, if for all the vertebrates, so the fishes, the reptiles, all of those things that can reproduce asexually, they all trace back to a hybrid of some sort. So there's a lot of asexual lizards, and they all trace back to hybridization between two species. So a lot of people have thought, well, maybe this is what's going on here, is that in the pet trade, of course, you put all kinds of things together that normally don't coexist, right? Because people just put whatever is pretty in their tanks. And so that's one possibility. And I'm hoping that at some point we're going to have somebody who's doing some genetics and these kinds of things to try and work that out. But there's so many crazy things that have been sort of people have talked about. So there was actually one paper that suggested that these were actually a genetic experiment from Hong Kong that got released accidentally. And I read that paper.
Right. Evil scientists did it again.
I looked at that and I went, whoa, where did that come from? Because I follow this stuff pretty closely and I had never heard that before. But yes, it is. Again, this whole story has this weird science fiction element to it, you know, of invaders, female clones, and they might carry plague, and all of these sorts of things. So it has this continuing air of unreality about it, but it's all real.
It's fascinating.
Of them being a genetic experiment. I'm not convinced about that one yet.
Not convinced about that part, right? Yeah, it is really fascinating, and it's interesting. It's a recent development as well. I mean, the science on this organ, this animal is, you know, like you said, it's really not well developed. We don't know a lot about it. And it's all the experiments, all the knowledge that we're gathering, it's all ongoing, and we just need people to work on it. For other things that you're interested in, communicating science is obviously very important. You teach, and I actually went to ratemyprofessors.com and saw that your students seem to like you. Your students seem to like you. Like, you got, you know, high in the mid 4 point whatevers. And you were rated the most, I guess students rated you difficult. You're not an easy teacher. But they like you.
I do neurobiology, you know, and it's like what are the phrases in the English language for something that is hard? Brain science? Rocket science. I do brain science. Everybody knows it's hard.
It's going to be a little hard, but hopefully fun.
Like, I don't do it to be mean. Well, you did brain science. You know this.
I know.
But that was why you got smart and ran.
I'm out of here. But other ways you communicate are, you know, of course, taking your scientific information and presenting it at conferences. And you have your blog, betterposters.blogspot.com, where you try and help other scientists make better posters. Why is this such a big issue for you?
It's funny because it's a big issue for me because I got tired of looking at so many bad ones. And for those who are not practicing scientists, the way that you present science at the big conferences, because you go to some of these, the Society for Neuroscience meeting is 30,000 people now, right?
Yeah, it's huge.
And it's massive. It's this massive, epic event. It rivals the San Diego Comic-Con. And it's actually held in the same building some years as Comic-Con. Not at the same time. But with 30,000 people coming, not everybody can get up and give their little, you know, 10-minute spiel about their research. So instead, what they do is they actually put up poster boards, and people have a poster that they give instead of an actual talk. And just because not everybody can give a talk. And, you know, so I go to neuroscience and or these other conferences, and I saw so many of these posters that were so bad. And, you know, you have these moments of somebody ought to do something about this. And that somebody was me. Trying to convince people of, no, things should actually line up. You don't need 12 different colors and 5 different fonts. These sorts of things.
Yeah, for design people, and I'm sure there are some design people in my audience, you know, this comes as second nature. But for scientists, we're not ever at any point taught the aesthetics of how to make things look good and how to present information. You know, if you build a website, it's a pretty basic website. You're not, you know, most scientists are not doing pretty, you know, making it beautiful with graphics and just the right font and all that kind of stuff. It's usually a scientist's presentation is the work that they're doing. It's not how it's presented.
And, you know, we're, you know, professors and researchers, we live in our heads, right? We're all about numbers and we're all about words. And people who get into science are more comfortable with numbers and words than a lot of other people. And so we forget reading is hard work. Figuring out graphs and numbers is hard work. And a lot of people are not used to that. And so, you know, scientists tend to go that route. And because they're amateurs and they're trying their best, you know, But, you know, as you say, nobody goes into science to do that kind of stuff. Right? And so it's very much that you see these people kind of making the amateur mistakes because that's what they are. They're amateurs. And I'm an amateur too, but hopefully I've done enough now and I've, you know, sort of seen other people and talked to other people that I've got a little bit of a head start on where other people are. And a lot of people have told me that they found that site really helpful. And so, you know, there's plenty of other websites that will tell you about how to give a great talk, great presentation, because so many people, you know, bring out the PowerPoint and do all that. But there really are not that many who will tell you if you want to do a poster, because it's very, I think, almost unique to science and academia and, you know, universities. Not a lot of business people go out and give poster presentations, whereas, you know, business and scientists go give PowerPoint presentations. So there's lots of information for that kind of stuff.
Are there any basics? Like if you had to give, you know, your top three or top five things that a scientist should think of when preparing a poster, what would you say?
Say less, or I should say write less. You're not writing an entire paper, you know. You don't have to put everything that is going to go into the published paper onto the poster. Say less. That's number one. Number two, pictures. Big, beautiful, high-quality pictures. Helps a lot.
Yeah.
That's sort of the follow-up to say, write less. And then number three, I would say, is make things line up. Get things aligned. Make a grid. And, you know, instead of having things that look a little bit off and, you know, having things kind of roughly, kind of sort of in places. No, columns, dudes. Rows, columns. Straight lines are good things in design. So those are my top three, I would say. Write less, more pictures, and put them on a grid.
I like that. I like your top three. And if any scientists out there are developing posters, check out his website, betterposters.blogspot.com, and take these three tips to heart. It's three of the big ones, but there are many, many more. I'm sure that you'll see it.
Just talking about neuroscience, that goes for all of you 20-some-odd thousand neuroscientists going to
exactly.
I don't want to see crappy posters when I go to the next neuroscience meeting.
Amen, amen. I agree. If I ever get back to neuroscience, I'll see if you've had any impact on the poster quality. We are coming to the end of the hour here. So is there anything else that in terms of the research that you're working on, in addition to Marmorcrebs, that's a big focus, but what else are you working on, and what other questions are you really focused on that that people might like to find out more about?
The next paper that I have coming out is about parasites. And I know I've heard you talk about things like Toxoplasma gondii, and I know that that's a really cool thing. But I've got a paper that I co-authored that are looking at crustacean parasites. And I come into this not because I'm really into parasites, but where the parasites live in this particular case is that they live in the nervous system of shrimp, as it turns out. And
wow,
yeah, and that for me kind of is wild, because there's plenty of parasites that live next to the nervous system, and we know that they affect the nervous system, but
right.
I'm just amazed that it turns out these are tapeworms, and these tapeworms actually bury into the nervous system, and I can't figure out how they can do that and the shrimp still looks okay. It turns out the behavior is a little different, but it's subtle. Like, I sort of think, for the number of parasites I've seen in the nervous system of these guys, I would think that they would be lying on their sides just twitching and then able to move. They do everything fine. They swim and they dig and they eat and they're all good. So that's one thing that I've been working on that I'm quite excited about. I think that's a really interesting story about how the parasites are getting in there and how they're affecting the behavior of the shrimp, so that the shrimp will get eaten and the parasite can go on continue its life cycle.
That is awesome. You work on really cool science fiction-y sounding stuff. You've got the invasive clone army, female clone army of Marmorcrebs, and the brain burrowing, the mind controlling parasites. Exactly.
The good news is that it's only a shrimp mind. And I've got to say again, controlling the mind of a shrimp, not that big of an achievement. They're not that bright.
Yeah. Not quite as many neurons. Yeah. Can you control a mammalian brain? That's when you've got some skills as a parasite.
That's serious parasite chops, yes.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for your time this hour, Dr. Zen. It's been really fun talking to you, and I've learned a lot about Marmorcrebs, and I appreciate your insight into making better posters and communicating science, getting scientists to communicate their science a little bit more clearly in little ways. Thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. For anybody else out there who's interested in finding out more about Marmorcrebs, be sure to visit drzen.net for more information. He has links out to his Marmorcrebs blog and his NeuroDojo blog, as well as the Better Posters. He's also on Twitter as Dr. Zen, so you can find him all sorts of places. And he's got some great things to say. So follow him and check out the work that he's doing on the web. I am Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Next week, we're switching gears from biology to physics, and we're going to be talking about matter and antimatter with Dr. Joel Fajans. He's just back from CERN, so maybe he'll have some insight as to what's happening at the LHC. Trapping antimatter. Woot! We're going to trap some here, maybe. Probably not, but we can try. Until next week, you can follow my sciencey pursuits on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, all these places except Google+, I'm Dr. Kiki. You can go to my website, drkiki.tv. Google+ won't let me be doctor. I just get to be Kiki, Kiki Sanford on Google+. That's about it. You can subscribe to Dr. Kiki Science Hour in iTunes, and you can find past episodes at twit.tv/Kiki. Also, if you need more sciencey goodness, you can listen to This Week in Science, which can be found at twist.org. I will see you next week. Thanks for tuning into my Science Hour. All I ask is one little hour of your time a week, and remember that 1 hour a week makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Now for your science meditation of the week.
I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist either.
Yo, we're climate scientists, and there's no denying this. Climate change is real. Who's a climate scientist? I'm a climate scientist. Not a Clio finalist, no, a climate scientist. Dropping facts all over this wax. While fitness be crying about a carbon tax. Yes. Climate change is caused by people. Earth on like alien has no sequel. We gotta move fast or we'll be forsaken.
Cause we were too busy sucking things in Copenhagen.
Hey, it's hot in here. 32% more carbon in the atmosphere.
Climate change on crack, permafrost subtracts, methane release is whack.